Part 1. The Roots. Primum non nocere. First, do no harm. Attributed to Hippocrates, but coined in 1860. Chapter 1. The Age of Syphilis. A Night with Venus, a Lifetime with Mercury. Adage describing the consequence of catching syphilis from a sexual encounter. Mercury was the main treatment for 4 centuries. The reversed loop. Epidemics have beginnings in both time and place, determining when and where they start, where they come from, and how they spread is the work of epidemiology. To take a close analogy, AIDS first appeared in the United States in 2 deadly disguises, skin cancer and pneumonia in gay men, and in 2 different places, Los Angeles and New York. The only thing the patients seemed to share was sexual orientation and immune suppression, but as CDC epidemiologists connected the dots, they came to a startling realization. AIDS appeared to be caused by an infectious, sexually transmitted agent, probably a virus. As in a reversed loop of film, the whole tumbling cascade of cards suddenly, and surprisingly, reformed into a neat deck. Ultimately, AIDS was traced back to Africa, although exactly how and when it migrated to America has been impossible to determine. Randy Schiltz, in And the Band Played On, envisioned one possible vector: the arrival of the tall ships in New York Harbor for the bicentennial celebration in July 1976. Ships from 55 nations had poured sailors into Manhattan to join the throngs. This was the part the epidemiologists would later note. The trajectory of syphilis was also a reversed loop. One speculation, when the Pinta, Niña, and Santa Maria sailed back into port in Spain from the Americas, their crews and captives were carrying the bacteria. The syphilis bacterium belongs to the Treponema pallidum species of the spirochete order. Spirochetes are so named because of their spiral coiled shape. Under a microscope, they wiggle like living corkscrews. Whether syphilis was part of the so-called Columbian Exchange, when diseases like measles and mumps arrived from the Old World to decimate huge swaths of the Americas, has been debated for centuries. Some scientists have argued that the syphilis bacterium was always present in Europe, and the timing of the epidemic in 1495 was a coincidence. But a consensus slowly has formed that syphilis was indeed among the gifts exchanged. Columbus brought syphilis to Europe along with tomatoes, gold, peppers, tobacco, chocolate, and many other wonders never before seen. They had left behind similar gifts in the Americas. The dramatic toll of new diseases in the New World has only recently been appreciated. Most notably, the idea that some 95% of its population died off without any direct contact with European civilization. Fatal diseases like measles and smallpox spread like wildfire through these virgin populations. This wild oscillation of the balance of nature happens again whenever an area previously isolated is opened to the rest of the world. But possibly it will never be repeated in as spectacular a fashion as in the Americas in the first post-Columbian century. Not unless there is, one day, an exchange of life forms between planets. If the toll of the Columbian Exchange was lower in the Old World than the New, it was a heavy toll nonetheless, and the onset of the syphilis epidemic in Europe can be dated much more precisely than AIDS in America. History records a specific event, the invasion of Naples by the French army of Charles VIII in 1495, as the natal moment. 22nd February, 1495, at 4 o'clock p.m., of the worldwide syphilis epidemic, writes Deborah Hayden in her superb blend of science and speculation, pox, genius, madness, and the mysteries of syphilis. French soldiers in retreat from Naples found themselves besieged by a very different enemy. Because the signs were so immediate and so much worse than even the dreaded smallpox, it soon gained the nickname of the Great Pox, or simply, the Pox. From there, syphilis spread unchecked. Many of the French army's soldiers were mercenaries, and significantly, many of those were from Columbus's Spain. Dispersing to their home countries, they planted syphilis like so many malignant seeds in a much more virulent form than we know today. Doctors seemed to compete in describing its horrors. Benedetto, a Venetian doctor writing in 1497, was one of the first. Through sexual contact, an ailment which is new, or at least unknown to previous doctors, the French sickness, has worked its way in from the west to this spot as I write. The entire body is so repulsive to look at, and the suffering is so great, especially at night, that this sickness is even more horrifying than incurable leprosy or elephantiasis, and it can be fatal. As Jared Diamond outlines in Guns, Germs, and Steel, today, our two immediate associations to syphilis are genital sores and very slowly developing disease, leading to the death of many untreated victims only after many years. However, when syphilis was first definitely recorded in Europe in 1495, its pustules often covered the body from the head to the knees, caused flesh to fall off people's faces, and led to death within a few months. By 1546, syphilis had evolved into the disease with the symptoms well known to us today. Those syphilis spirochetes that evolved so as to keep their victims alive for longer were thereby able to transmit the spirochete offspring into more victims. Following the principle that microbes invariably adapt to their host, the virulence with which syphilis attacked Europe before subsiding into a more chronic affliction argues for its more recent arrival on the continent of Europe. Neurosyphilis. As ferocious as syphilis could be when the disease first broke out, perhaps equally frightening was a related condition, general paresis of the insane, which came to light in the early 1800s. Paresis is an antiquated term for paralysis, or more precisely, impaired movement. So the words imply some of its horrors. Before penicillin put an end to the age of syphilis in the mid-20th century, a small, highly variable percentage of syphilitics succumbed to the physical and mental ravages of a lethal condition. General paralysis of the insane, or GPI, as it was widely known. GPI could sneak up on its victims, provoking uncharacteristic outbursts and memory lapses, headaches, weakness, and tremors in the limbs. Less frequently, it announced itself in an instant. Friedrich Nietzsche collapsed on a street in Turin in 1889, suffering a massive breakdown, and spent years in an asylum before dying in 1897. However it presented, general paralysis of the insane was one of the most cruelly debilitating diseases ever described. GPI before penicillin was akin to AIDS before retroviral therapy, both in mode of transmission and in its relentlessly grim consequences, leaving many of its victims incontinent, insane, and immobilized. We owe some of the most detailed descriptions of this condition to the German psychiatrist Emile Kraepelin, 1856 to 1926, widely considered the father of modern scientific psychiatry. Kraepelin was convinced that mental illness was an organic, biological process, and that treatment required science, technology, and a combined understanding of biology in the brain. His clear delineation between affective disorders like depression and mania and psychotic disorders like schizophrenia remains the foundation of 21st century psychiatry. The usual clinical picture of general paresis is a progressive deterioration leading to complete undermining of the whole mental and physical personality, accompanied by peculiar irritative and paralytic phenomena. Kraepelin wrote, in General Paresis, a 200-page chapter in his monumental and authoritative textbook of psychiatry, which was translated into English in 1913. The termination of paresis is regularly death. In writing about GPI, Kraepelin identified an Alzheimer's-like decline. The patient is absent-minded, inattentive, does not grasp events transpiring about him with accustomed clearness. He mistakes persons and objects, overlooks important circumstances or changes, loses himself among familiar surroundings. In addition, he noted a marked change in disposition. The patient is capricious, easily angered and surly, thrown into transitory states of emotional excitement by trivial causes, at which times he completely loses control of himself and flies into a violent passion. The physical side of the condition was also progressive. Symptoms included impaired movement coordination, sight impairment, and sensations of numbness in varying areas of the body. The motor symptoms are especially prominent in paresis. The patient cannot catch a quickly moving object, button the coat, thread a needle, or knit. The condition spared few faculties, attacking also the senses. On the sensory side, there are similar attacks. Defects in the visual fields. A hand goes to sleep, the fingers get numb, one side seems to the patient to be swollen, an arm becomes dead and is useless for half a day. Another common symptom was digestive problems. Typically, over the course of 2 to 4 more years, the physical debilities evolved into paralysis and the mental disturbances into insanity. Then, to shorten Kraepelin's phraseology, you died. The only good thing to be said about GPI was that the wreckage was so complete you often didn't know you had it. Paretics seldom have a true realization of their condition, Kraepelin wrote. On the contrary, the patients frequently feel healthier than previously, or, at least, they do not appreciate they have lost all their mental powers. General paralysis was not the only neurological condition associated with syphilis. There were 2 other major categories, and many variations, including meningovascular syphilis and tubes dorsalis, which affected the spinal cord and the peripheral nervous system. All went under the general category of neurosyphilis, meaning involvement of the brain, the nervous system, or both. But one sign made GPI stand out. Some of the most grandiose delusions ever recorded in the psychiatric literature. Here, Kraepelin catalogues just a few. Note that these were being experienced by early 20th century Germans. The patient thinks he possesses extraordinary physical strength, can lift 10 elephants, is 800 years old, 9 feet tall, the most beautiful Adonis in the world, weighs 400 pounds, increases 25 pounds every week, has an iron chest, sinews like a man-eater, an arm of silver, a head of pure gold, travels 1,000 miles a minute, can fly. He is infinite, has died and again come to life, can have intercourse with 100 women, has 1,000 million boys and girls, a compressed brain, has run a race with the Grand Duke. His urine is Rhine wine. His evacuations are gold. 10 years ago he had an enormous cancer. His sexual organs and fingers are constantly getting larger. His brain is still growing. He has an immense movement of the bowels. He has studied all sciences, speaks all the languages in the world, plays Wagner at sight. impersonates Don Carlos like a god. There was no shortage of spectacularly delusional statements to report. This was just one paragraph from pages and pages of such descriptions. And GPI was as baffling as it was bizarre. Although the syphilis epidemic hit Europe like a tidal wave in 1495, GPI and its unmistakable manifestations were not observed until 300 years later. One of its first widely accepted descriptions is from 1809, when John Haslam of Bethlehem Asylum, also known as Bedlam, in England wrote, "Persons this disordered are in general not at all sensible of being so affected. When so feeble as scarcely to be able to stand, they commonly say that they feel perfectly strong and capable of great exertions." A further complication was that once a person was infected with syphilis, it usually took years for GPI to show up, typically 12 to 15 years, though sometimes as few as 3 or 4, and sometimes far longer. For that reason, the best medical minds in Europe were slow to realize that everyone with GPI had syphilis, though not everyone with syphilis developed GPI. Indeed, GPI affected a relatively small percentage of all those with syphilis. No one knew for sure what the GPI rate among syphilitics was. Estimates varied from 5 to more than 20%. All they knew was that, like syphilis itself centuries before, GPI seemed to come out of nowhere, and it was on the rise, filling the hospitals and asylums of Europe. A meeting at Hiawatha. In April 1925, 69-year-old Emil Kreplin came all the way from the University of Munich Hospital to the Hiawatha Asylum for Insane Indians in Canton, South Dakota. He was in search of Native Americans with syphilis. More specifically, he was looking for general paralysis of the insane, and the federal government's sole mental hospital for Native Americans seemed like a good place to find it. Another doctor, Leo Kanner, had also come to Hiawatha to meet the great Kreplin in order to help him overcome the language barrier with the locals and to tell him that he had found what he was looking for, a Native American with general paralysis of the insane. At the time, Leo Kanner was a psychiatrist at South Dakota's State Mental Hospital in Yankton. Yet in a sense, Kanner had come as far as Kreplin. An Austrian by birth, Kanner had been living in Berlin only the year before, when he accepted an offer to join the staff of the Yankton State Hospital. Serendipity was one of Kanner's favorite words. "I do not hesitate to say that I seem to be endowed with serendipity, or the gift of finding unsought treasures," he wrote near the end of his long career. Leaving Germany before Hitler's ascent was clear serendipity, and connecting with Kreplin was too. It would help lead to his appointment at a great teaching hospital, to establish the first childhood psychiatric clinic, to writing the first American textbook on the subject, and to becoming, like Kreplin, a patriarch in his own right, the father of child psychiatry. Kanner played a key role in several of the medical sagas described in this audiobook, including, as we noted in the introduction, the discovery of autism. Kreplin had a theory, one that led him to North America and ultimately to Hiawatha. He believed that alcohol made syphilis worse and was probably the cause of GPI. Sounding a bit like a prohibitionist, the 18th Amendment was in effect by the time Kreplin arrived at Hiawatha in 1925. He wrote that "peoples who are not susceptible to paresis, GPI, are entirely or nearly free from alcoholic influence, either because they have no alcohol industries to flood the country with their products, or because legal or religious precepts demand abstinence." He made it clear that freed slaves and the North American Indians who are well supplied with whiskey in their reservations had especially succumbed to both alcohol, and GPI. This was no passing reference. Again and again he put forward the assertion. He wrote that Native Americans with syphilis suffer severely from paresis, and he emphasized, "It is remarkable with what extraordinary rapidity paresis has spread among the Negroes and Indians of North America." There was one problem. Kraepelin had no evidence. So, early in 1925, Kraepelin set off on what would be his last field investigation, a three-month journey through the United States, Mexico, and Cuba, to investigate the incidence of GPI in blacks and Native Americans. Assuming alcohol triggered GPI in syphilitics, the evidence would not be hard to find. The evidence was not hard to find. It was impossible to find. By the time Kraepelin got to Canton, he had not encountered a single case of GPI among Native Americans with syphilis, nor were there any at the Hiawatha Asylum for Insane Indians. The scarcity of GPI stood in stark contrast to the high prevalence of syphilis on Native American reservations. This large population of Native Americans with syphilis did not suffer greatly from GPI, as Kraepelin had asserted. Quite the opposite. They didn't seem to suffer from it at all. Enter Serendipity. Canner had learned from the Sioux City newspaper that Kraepelin would be nearby looking for GPI among North American blacks and Native Americans, and managed to persuade his boss, G.S. Adams, the Yankton superintendent, to get invitations to meet both Kraepelin and Felix Plout, one of his assistants, at Hiawatha. Canner wasted no time in connecting with the great man. "Their curiosity was aroused when I told them that we had at Yankton a paretic Indian. In all their travels, they had not been able to lay eyes on one. Kraepelin was excited and, regretting that arrangements had been made for him to leave for Mexico the following morning, made me promise that I mail the data to him and that I publish the case in detail." But the case Canner mentioned was hardly a typical Native American. The patient was a farmer named Thomas T. Robertson. In photos taken at Yankton, he wore a coat and tie. His great-grandfather was a Scotsman of the same name who had joined the Sioux Nation in South Dakota's early days as a territory. While the rest of his ancestors were Sioux, though all the men kept the Tom Robertson name, his delusions as well as his pedigree reflected a European influence. Mental state. When last examined in April 1925, he was partially oriented as to the place. He knew that this was Yankton, but did not realize what kind of a place he was living in. As the date, he gave the second and third months of 1924. His memory is very poor now, his answers often irrelevant. He has several delusions of grandeur. He has $2 million in a bank. He takes care of all the houses, all the horses, all the cattle, all the farms, and everything. He is to be married to a young preacheress of a very good family. He is the best man in the world next to Jesus Christ. When he marries that girl, he will be able to make people very rich. He is going to be a powerful man. He will become President of the United States. The Lord has appeared to him several times in dreams, and he is proud of these visions, and attaches great importance to them. On the ward he behaves quite well, is fairly clean in his habits. His insight into his condition is extremely poor, and so is his judgment about his fellow patients. He is always happy, and when asked to do so, he will gladly sing some of his Indian songs and dance some of his tribal dances. He runs a floor polisher on the ward, and does other coarse work possible with his incoordinate movements. Diagnosis: dementia paralytica, GPI, mesorrhytis syphilitica, volumen pulmonum octum, heart and lung problems. This Native American obviously had a foot in the Western world. A Sioux named Robertson, who imagined millions in the bank, who wanted to be Jesus Christ and the President of the United States, was not representative, and Kanner knew it even at the time. It appears, furthermore, of the greatest importance, not that an Indian has been found affected with general paralysis, but that such a case is so rare that it is really regarded as a curiosity, a fact that very decidedly calls for explanation. By contrast, in Europe and most parts of the United States, you could find GPI effortlessly. It represented one of the largest single-patient populations in any mental hospital, as many as 25% of men. Still, to find even one instance among Native Americans was considered a publishable accomplishment. To my knowledge, Thomas T. Robertson has remained to this day the only paretic Indian to be fully studied and reported, Kanner wrote years later. He certainly looked hard, getting in touch with every hospital that could conceivably have an Indian paretic as a patient, and checking with Dr. Hubert Work, Secretary of the Interior, who was also a leading neurologist. Work told Kanner that the department was about halfway through a census of general paresis among Native Americans, and so far had found none. It may be said that general paralysis is extremely rare, even in tribes that are known to be more or less syphilitic. The U.S. Census listed a grand total of one whom Kanner tried in vain to locate. He may well have died. The evidence was convincing. GPI was practically non-existent in Native American populations, so what was going on? Kanner and Adams observed that after syphilis first hit Europe, its initial and outward manifestations gradually became less severe, though it remained a deadly, chronic affliction. They cited the likelihood that syphilis originated in the Americas, that it had been endemic here thousands of years longer. Then they put the two ideas together to form their own theory, that the longer syphilis resided in a people, the milder an affliction it became. In that case, Native Americans, having been exposed to syphilis for centuries longer than Europeans, would display less GPI. They called attention to the fact that Tom Robertson was 1/16 Scot, implying a sliver of European heritage could have made him more susceptible. This was an imaginative speculation, but not particularly plausible. Syphilis would have to enter a new population without causing GPI, then in a spontaneous event several centuries later, suddenly mutate into a neurotoxic strain, as in Europe, and then at a later date, for reasons unknown, the neurotoxic strain would spontaneously disappear, as in Native Americans. Why would this occur? There was also no evidence that once GPI emerged after centuries of syphilis's circulation in European populations, it had begun to decline. Quite the opposite. It was the seventh leading cause of death in New York State in 1914, tied with typhoid fever and claiming about 1,000 lives a year. One in nine New York males who died between ages 40 and 60 died of GPI, far more than all other complications of syphilis combined. If only by process of elimination, the question of treatment must arise. Europeans and European Americans used mercury to treat syphilis, while Native Americans and many other less advanced cultures largely did not. Now, listen to these observations by Kanner and Adams in that light. It has been agreed upon, it is true, that the disease occurs most frequently in the civilized countries and that natives of regions where there is a lower civilization and where the struggle for existence is less exhaustive are comparatively free from it, and it has been stated that members of such races or tribes found to be affected with general paralysis have either brought it back from their sojourn in Europe or else have become Europeanized in their habits of life. Others were making global comparisons as well, Kraepelin among them. Note the similar findings and the interesting anomalies. Of much greater significance for the understanding of paresis are the extraordinary differences in its frequency in different countries. While in France, England, Italy, Austria, the Netherlands, Switzerland, in Western Russia and the Eastern United States, almost the same relations, that is, high prevalence rates, obtain as in Germany. In Norway, according to Vogt's personal observations, paresis is so rare that sometimes there is not a single case in the institution of 330 beds at Gaustadt. GPI is apparently unknown in British East Africa, Uganda, Zanzibar, Cameroon, Togo, Samoa, the Marshall Islands, and in Nicaragua. One can sympathize with Kraepelin's difficulty in sorting out this data. GPI seemed to be European, yet, according to Ragnar Vogt, one of the leading Norwegian experts in neurosyphilis, in Norway it was absent. It may have been caused by consumption of alcohol, but then alcoholic Indians with syphilis didn't get it. It seemed to be racial/genetic, but then race didn't offer protection when individuals changed their environment. Kraepelin concluded that one may consider first the habits of life, which indeed have a profound effect on the people's health. But the notion that medicine might have been that habit just didn't occur to Kraepelin, nor to Kanner, nor Adams, perhaps because it could only mean doctors were causing the worst manifestation of syphilis, and that was simply inconceivable. Yet, as we'll see, by then there was plenty of controversy about exactly what side effects medicinal mercury was triggering. And we have found contemporary evidence that Indians treated syphilis differently. Here is an account from 1812. We have been told that the natives of America cure the venereal disease in every stage by a decoction of the root of a plant called lobelia. It is used either fresh or dried, but we have no certain accounts with regard to the proportion. A footnote adds, though we are still very much in the dark with regard to the method of curing this disease among the natives of America, nothing is more certain than that they do cure it with speed, safety, and success, and that without the least knowledge of mercury. A second source also notes the different way Native Americans dealt with syphilis. In the journals of Lewis and Clark on their voyage westward 2 decades later, Meriwether Lewis discusses treating a member of the expedition with mercury for syphilis, and also how Indians treated it with lobelia. Although Indians in the Southwest and California made war paint from cinnabar, we have found no evidence they used mercury internally, for syphilis, or for any other purpose. According to John N. Lowe, a visiting assistant professor in the American Indian Studies program at the University of Illinois, medicinal uses of mercury would have required mining and transport, a greater degree of industrialization than Indian culture possessed, and there was relatively little trade between Western and American Indian civilizations, according to Lowe. This pattern of finding no instances of GPI in populations that had not been treated with mercury continued. In 1938, just a few years before penicillin rendered mercury obsolete, researchers observed, several authorities have expressed the opinion that cerebral and neurological lesions due to syphilis are extremely rare among Indians in North America. The scarcity of characteristic signs of syphilis in the Indian groups studied in Yucatan and in Guatemala is the more significant because the disease had not been checked by the use of recognized forms of treatment. Not using recognized forms of treatment, which by 1938 included mercury and arsenic, but not yet penicillin, may have spared the American Indians the brain lesions symptomatic of neurosyphilis. Kanner and Adams's paper, General Paralysis Among the North American Indians, A Contribution to Racial Psychiatry, appeared in the July 1926 issue of the prestigious American Journal of Psychiatry. Along with a follow-up and several other papers in medical journals, Kanner's work at Yankton won him a fellowship at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore, where he stayed for the rest of his working life. Kraepelin died the same year the Canner Adams paper appeared. While at work on the 2,700-page ninth edition of his textbook of psychiatry. 8 years after their visit, the federal government was shamed into closing Hiawatha, the site where Canner and Kraepelin crossed paths, is now a golf course. A graveyard for more than 100 Indians who died at Hiawatha is between the fourth and fifth fairways. The disease of the remedy. Mercury had long been used as a treatment for the scabs of leprosy and other conditions because its toxic properties killed bacteria by contact. So when faced with the horrific lesions of syphilis, doctors reached for the element they already knew could relieve skin disorders. In fact, lesions did diminish, leading to the seemingly obvious conclusion that syphilis could be cured with adequate treatment, immediate, vigorous, and prolonged application of mercury. But from the start, treatment came with delayed effects and a disturbing question. Mercury was killing the superficial spirochetes, yes, but what else was it destroying? Giacomo Berengario da Carpi used mercury on hundreds of patients in Italy in 1495, but had to leave town in a hurry because the cure frequently proved worse than the disease. He did wisely to get out of Rome, according to one account, for not many months afterwards all the patients he had treated grew so ill they were 100 times worse off than before he came. He would certainly have been murdered if he had stopped. As syphilis spread throughout Europe and around the globe, killing millions as it went, treatments became more ambitious, elaborate, and inevitably dangerous. Patients coated in mercury often stayed wrapped in bedclothes for weeks or sweated in overheated rooms next to hot fires, treatments believed to hasten mercury's work of expelling toxins. They sat in baths saturated with mercury or squatted on stools above a steaming cauldron of it inside makeshift tents. They salivated quarts of liquid, their teeth loosened and fell out, and while they might have gotten some relief from the immediate outward manifestations of syphilis, in the long run, they got no better. There were many besides da Carpi who learned that mercury made things worse. By 1811, British surgeon Andrew Matthias summed up 3 centuries of controversy. Another effect of mercury is that debility which it produces after it has been employed for a great length of time and in excessive doses, he wrote. Mercury appears to destroy the energy of the nervous system, producing weakness, tremors, palsies, epilepsy, and mania, the most dreadful of all its consequences. The reference to epilepsy and to mania as the most dreadful effect, coming in 1810, could have been an early observation of GPI. Matthias freely acknowledged he was not the first to point this out. "I pretend not to the discovery of a new complaint," he said. Rather, he wanted to show that mercury in some instances ceases to act as a remedy and produces a specific action in the system, differing entirely from all its other operations, having in itself a power of suppressing, but not of curing, the venereal action. When mercury begins to disagree with the constitution and ceases to act in removing the venereal virus, this disagreement is constantly to be accounted for from this morbid specific action taking place, which, if the expression may be allowed, I would wish to call the disease of the remedy. Despite the antiquated language, this was a useful set of observations. Mercury could suppress, but did not cure syphilis. Its use over a long period in people with syphilis had uniquely damaging effects, and the nervous system seemed especially at risk. Mercury was even dangerous to those who provided the treatment. "Inunctions of mercury mixed with lard and other emollients to create rubs were sometimes performed with a spatula at what practitioners hoped was a safe distance. It was not. As early as 1713, in Diseases of Workers, Bernardino Ramazzini observed, "Mercury nowadays is no less dangerous for surgeons and others who administer mercurial inunction in the worst cases of lues venere, which every other remedy has failed to cure. At present, those who anoint with mercurial ointment persons afflicted with syphilis belong to the lowest class of surgeons who carry on for the money to be made. For the better sort of surgeons avoid a service so disagreeable and a task so full of danger and hazard. Though they wear a glove when so engaged, it is impossible for them to prevent the mercurial atoms from penetrating the leather. Moreover, since this work is done before a blazing fire, it is inevitable that noxious exhalations taken in by the mouth and nose should reach the internal organs, so that they rub this dire mischief in their brains and nerves." But given the terrors of the epidemic, critics of the mercury remained on the margins. Despite all the evidence and concern, the heart of the medical profession remained committed to mercury treatment, and mainstream physicians rose strongly to its defense. Although in the 16th century there was vehement opposition to the mercurial treatment of syphilis, wrote French physician Henri Dujardin Beaumetz in 1885, "the war against the hydrargyrate, mercury, treatment, has been waged with the greatest violence in this present century." He fumed that some doctors have gone so far as to affirm that the accidents, effects, observed in syphilis are due to mercury. Speaking out against the treatment was viewed as heresy not to be tolerated, especially not by the mainstream medical establishment of the day, battling a gruesome disease armed with almost no weaponry. Mercury was used everywhere and intensively from the beginning and for a very long time. And while every city experienced the ravages of syphilis and the risks inherent in using mercury as a mainstay, one European capital was especially hard hit and became the center of treatment innovation. Inventing the Vienna treatment. For the capital of a small country, 8.3 million people, Vienna is incongruously magnificent. Ornate apartments are bathed in light at evening. Exquisite public buildings and fountain-splashed plazas crowd together within the Ringstrasse, the broad boulevard that encircles the central city, built on the fortifications that once surrounded it. The immense St. Stephen's Cathedral, blackened with soot except for the restored tile roof, rises from the center, brooding, ancient, and overpowering. All this grandeur makes sense when you consider that Vienna was once capital of the mighty Austro-Hungarian Empire, an epoch that includes some of the defining figures in all world history: Mozart, Strauss, Klimt, Wittgenstein, Popper, Asperger, Bettelheim, Hitler, Freud, Kafka. There was no grander moment than that of the Habsburg Empress, Maria Theresia, 1717-1780. A builder of institutions as well as grand architecture, Maria Theresia used the vast wealth of her realm to redesign the city, reform the army and the economy, and turn Vienna into one of the great capitals of the world. And she was determined to bring it to the forefront of European medical practice as well. In this pursuit, she stepped outside both her country and its Catholic religion, recruiting one of medicine's up-and-coming names from Protestant Holland, one Gerard van Swieten. She commissioned him to overhaul the fragmented and nepotistic medical establishment of the day and run it with a hierarchical and systematic model. The Viennese school would soon rival Paris and London, and all three cities developed what has been called a spiritual connection, as the world's most advanced centers of medical practice and education. Van Swieten is an iconic figure in Viennese medical history. He has a street named after him that runs alongside the massive military hospital and medical school. The Empress built him a luxurious house on the edge of the Schönbrunn Gardens. As her personal doctor, he had Maria Theresia's ear and could do things that might have gotten another courtier decapitated. On one occasion, he plopped food, equivalent to the meal the plump monarch was eating, into a pail to demonstrate her overindulgence. But, like other cities in Europe, there was a dark side to Vienna. It was rife with prostitution, and syphilis was the great scourge of the army garrisoned there that maintained the far-flung patchwork empire. Maria Theresia took decisive action. She outlawed prostitution and shipped its practitioners out of town, in large part to keep them away from the troops. Von Swieten himself had a keen interest in the health of the military, and soon the Garnisonspital, Garrison Hospital, became the leading institution of syphilis treatment and mercury therapeutics for all of Europe. Von Swieten was an effective administrator and a medical innovator as well. Concerned about the long-term internal consequences of syphilis infection, including bone disease, cardiovascular problems, and gummaceous lesions, spongy masses that slowly grow inside the body, he decided doctors needed to do more than just rub mercury on the skin. They needed a way of internally administering mercurial medicine that would deliver it more directly to the spirochetes that lurked deep inside the tissues of the body. This was not an easy task. In the wrong amounts or the wrong form, mercury could either poison its host or fail to reach its target. His solution was a liquid form of mercuric chloride that became known as Von Swieten's liquor. Mercuric chloride, also called mercury chloride 2, mercury bichloride, or corrosive sublimate, had been synthesized many years previously and was known to be many times more toxic than mercurous chloride. The Calomel Elizabeth story received that destroyed her teeth and jaw. It was even used as a poison. In the early 1800s in England, Mary Bateman, also known as the Yorkshire Witch, was a fortune-teller and swindler who got her clients to give her everything they had. She tried to hasten the demise of one recalcitrant couple with mercuric chloride, only managing to kill the wife. Mary Bateman probably should have picked a quicker and less obvious poison. She died on the gallows in March 1809. Von Swieten explored smaller dosing, and because mercuric chloride was soluble in water, he came up with the idea of oral administration. Its appeal was obvious. According to D.R. de Horn, a French specialist during the era of Louis XVI, using corrosive sublimate, mercuric chloride, one can treat in secret even the very bosom of the family, a young man who has mistakenly erred, or a husband whose misfortune will make him wiser and more careful, and with it, one can bring about that return to duty which the public revelation of their licentiousness sometimes causes men to abandon irrevocably. Given this advantage, Van Swieten's influence, and the importance of syphilis treatment, mercuric chloride became the standard of care throughout Europe by the end of the 18th century, and Swietini's liquor, as it was also called, was his lasting legacy. With the Vienna medical establishment in place and officially sanctioned methods of treatment widely accepted, a new age of Viennese public health emerged, not necessarily improved in terms of its outcome, but certainly better organized. Prostitutes were accepted back into the city as long as they registered. A department of syphilis, the world's first, emerged at the University of Vienna. But mercury, no matter how it was deployed in or on the human body, did not vanquish syphilis or prevent its transmission, and syphilis rates, most notably among the elites and the upper classes of Vienna, remained epidemic. In fact, fear of the disease may have led to overprescribing of mercury and subsequent mercury poisoning for other ailments that mimicked syphilis. Because mercury and syphilis exposures in Vienna were so widespread, it is likely that many of its citizens, prostitutes, and military officers, as well as many of its most elite, were affected by this poisoning. In this light, one case study of a man whose death in 1791 has remained the subject of widespread speculation caught our notice. A man many consider the greatest musician who ever lived. Genius interrupted. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart knew syphilis. It scared him to death. That's why he put off seeing his friend, fellow composer, Josef Myslivecek, as long as he could. But in 1777 Mozart was in Munich, rustling up musical commissions, and Myslivecek was being treated at a hospital there. Mozart arranged to meet him in the hospital garden, where his friend strolled from 11 to noon. He knew part of Myslivecek's nose had been cut off to counter the ravages of the disease, but the actual encounter still shocked him almost speechless. "When he came up to me," Mozart wrote his father shortly afterward, "I took him by his hand and he took mine, in friendship. Just look," he said, "how unfortunate I am." His words and his appearance, which Papa knows already from earlier descriptions, touched me so deeply that I couldn't say anything except, half crying, "My dear friend, I feel for you with all my heart." In 1777, Maria Theresia may have ruled the empire, but Mozart ruled Vienna. The man whose bust now occupies the centermost spot in the city's central cultural institution, the Opera House, was the superstar of his day. Adept at composing not only opera, but concertos and symphonies as well, he dazzled the court with his presence and the prospect of decades more of his wonderful music. In his private life, too, the stars seemed to shine on Mozart. At 19, he married Constanze, with whom he had 6 children. By all accounts, they remained passionately in love, and his frequent letters show his devotion in vivid language. While few question the depth of his love, there is little doubt that Mozart carried on affairs as well. Like a celebrity of any era, the temptations were enormous, and the times when his wife was pregnant, and, as was the custom, often away at a spa to ensure a safe pregnancy, provided both means and opportunity. Did he have such an opportunity in June 1791? Constanze, pregnant again, was at the Baden Spa just outside Vienna. Her last pregnancy had ended with the baby's death during childbirth. With the summer heat bearing down, a rest cure seemed wise. Mozart wrote frequently, 16 letters in 6 weeks. He also visited her, but stayed in the city and was busy professionally and quite possibly amorously. He was at work on the greatly anticipated The Magic Flute, due to be presented that fall at the Opera House. Mozart's close collaborator was a man named Emanuel Schikaneder, his longtime librettist and an active member of the Viennese social scene. When it came to fidelity, Herr Schikaneder would not have been a positive influence. He was widely recognized to be a libertine. His reputation as a ladies' man was so extreme that it even presented professional problems for him. There's documentary evidence that in the summer of 1791, Mozart was socializing with Schikaneder and women who were not his wife. On June 6th, he wrote his first letter to Constanze in Baden. "I am going to be here, at a friend's house, this evening also, for now that I have given Leonor, the maid, notice, I would be all alone in the house, and that's not to my liking." That same day, the Wiener Zeitung newspaper reported that Mozart went to the Freihaus Theater with Frau Anna von Schwingenschuh. to see Schikaneder's comic opera, Anton at Court, or The Name Day. Mozart's companion was the wife of an assistant at the Mint. If this was a dalliance, it was probably not his first with a married woman. One alleged mistress was a beautiful, married, 23-year-old piano student of Mozart's, Magdalena Hofdimmel. On July 26th, Constanze gave birth to their sixth child, Franz Xaver Wolfgang. In the midst of this swirl of activity, Mozart already had busy plans for the fall. In September, he was due in Prague to write a score celebrating the coronation of King Leopold II. On August 25th, he and Constanze left on a three-day journey from Vienna to Prague. We know from historical sources that Mozart's mood, despite the safe birth of Franz, had turned dark. In Prague, he was depressed and concerned about illness. One possibility, although never confirmed, is that sometime in the previous weeks and months, Mozart had discovered the first signs of a recently acquired case of syphilis. If he had, or even suspected that was the case, he would not have had to look very far to obtain the remedy. There is no question he could have relied on one of his closest friends. One thing is certain. While in Prague, his concern over some illness caused him to take aggressive action to treat himself. According to one translation, he dosed himself ceaselessly with medicine. Consider then the following scenario, one that combines motive, means, and opportunity. Mozart acquired or believed he acquired syphilis during a liaison that occurred in the summer of 1791. By the fall, as the signs became apparent to him, he began to treat himself with the remedy of the day, Van Swieten's liquor. Developed by Gerard van Swieten in Vienna just a few decades earlier, and if he had questions about whether to use this powerful new cure or how to get it, he would have had little difficulty obtaining a supply from a friend on whom he relied many other times, Gottfried van Swieten, Gerard's son. Mercury, as a poison, generally did not act rapidly. It took days and weeks to take effect. In the days subsequent to Mozart's return to Vienna in October, his health began a rapid descent. On October 20th, he spoke to Constanze about death. She commented on his declining health and told Mozart's first biographer, Franz Niemetschek, that he responded, "Certainly one has given me poison. Gewiss man hat mir Gift gegeben." Over the next few weeks, Mozart's health became worse and worse. His systems seemed to be shutting down, and he may have come down with a fever in addition to his general feelings of ill health. He died on December 5th, 1791, and the presiding doctor gave the cause as Hitziges Fieselfieber, or acute military fever. The Oxford English Dictionary defines this as a specific disease characterized by the presence of a rash resembling measles, the spots of which exhibit in their centers minute vesicles of the form of millet seed. Could that have been the rash of secondary syphilis? Many theories have pointed to some medical problem, though the specifics vary. Speculations include rheumatic fever and a rare disease called Henoch-Schönlein syndrome. More recently, it's even been proposed that he had food poisoning from pork. One of the most common medical theories is that he died of kidney disease. This explanation would be consistent with self-medication with Van Swieten's liquor. Kidney damage is one of the characteristic signs of mercury poisoning. Another school of thought purports that Mozart was deliberately poisoned. Constanze later said he told her he thought the poison was arsenic, in the form of a deadly substance called aqua tofana. Mercury has also been suggested as the poison, and culprits from the Masons, he attended a lodge meeting the week he became ill, to Jews, to Salieri have been not very convincingly implicated. Historians have widely condemned the mercury murder conspiracies, probably for good reason, but in the process have thrown out the idea of self-medication with mercury, potentially supplied by his friend, Gottfried. The idea that Van Swieten's liquor, possibly interacting with a new syphilis infection, killed Mozart is a scenario, not a proof. Syphilis was clearly rampant in Vienna, and fear of syphilis was even more epidemic, as witnessed by Mozart's visit to his disfigured friend in Vienna. We are not the first to speculate that Mozart had affairs, that he had acquired syphilis, or that he suffered from poisoning. We are not even the first to question whether that poison was mercury. But we are connecting these ideas in a different way and suggesting another link: his friendship with the son of the inventor of the Vienna treatment. The death blow is struck from the first. GPI surfaced not long after Mozart's death, but the syndrome took much longer to surface in America. One reason the disease may have been previously unknown in the United States is that Van Swieten's liquor was a European invention, to arrive later in the United States and supplant calomel, which had been the mainstay of American venereal treatment. The 1860 edition of an American medical handbook, Gunn's Domestic Medicine, refers to Van Swieten's as a French and British treatment, and among material remedies used in other countries. Nonetheless, when GPI occurred in the United States, it showed remarkably similar symptoms to the European manifestation, according to two American doctors. Men in the prime of life, intelligent and of active habits, have perhaps sustained a single attack of paralysis, a slight impairment of the mind, a slight faltering in the speech, and a little infirmity in the gait, only discovered by those who look for it, are the most prominent symptoms. Yet, in all these cases, the death blow is struck from the first. Their health, they say, was never so good, their mind never so clear, their prosperity never so secure. Fits of a convulsive character, sometimes decidedly epileptic, often supervene in this state, and each attack leaves the mind and body weaker, until a paroxysm more severe than common proves fatal, wrote one doctor. Another claimed, "The form of delusions has almost always borne reference to immense amount of money, great power, or some similar exaltation. No recovery has occurred among them." These vivid accounts, so consistent with the observations of Kreppelin in Germany, Kanner in Yankton, and Haslam in England, show how identifiable the disease was. One Parisian doctor named E. Esquirol made an observation in 1845 that came excruciatingly close to the heart of the matter. "This complication, paralysis in the insane, is most frequently observed among that class of insane persons who have yielded to venereal excesses, or have been addicted to the use of alcoholic drinks. Among those also who have made an inordinate use of mercury, as well as those who, exercising the brain too vigorously, in mental strife, have, at the same time, abandoned themselves to errors of regimen." There are four possible clues to GPI in that one paragraph: alcohol, mental strife in advanced civilization, venereal disease, and mercury. It is fascinating to see Emile Kreppelin nearly a century later pursuing the alcohol-induced GPI idea at Hiawatha, and puzzling over the risk to those in advanced cultures. But the real combination of clues in Esquirol's 1845 observation, mercury and syphilis coming together in advanced cultures, went unnoticed. In the meantime, the Viennese and their close research partners in Germany continued to work on improving treatments for syphilis. In the early 1860s, just across the border from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, George Lewin, working cooperatively with Karl Ludwig Siegmund's practice in Vienna, took Sweetini's liquor to its next logical step. Instead of having patients swallow mercuric chloride, Lewin and Siegmund decided to deliver it more directly through injections. Writing in 1872, Lewin reported that public health authorities had immediately adopted his quick and easy treatment in their most at-risk population. Prostitutes. While prostitutes suspected of having syphilis were forced to get mercuric chloride injections, Emil Kreplin, also in Germany, observed that young women suffering from GPI were strikingly often prostitutes, noting that 11% of the women in a mental hospital in Berlin were prostitutes, while prostitutes comprised only 1.7% of Berlin's female population. Paresis has apparently not yet been observed in nuns, he noted without comment. In Paris, Esquirol, too, noticed a connection between paralytic insanity and prostitution. He reported that although GPI was far more frequent among men than women, nevertheless, 1 in 20 of the patients in Paris's famed Salpêtrière Hospital were female prostitutes, and they generally sink into the most profound misery and, as a consequence, into dementia of a paralytic form. All these observations point in the same direction. GPI arose with the internal use of mercuric chloride to treat syphilis. Groups that got intensive, frequent, and long-term treatment were much more likely to succumb to GPI, while in untreated populations it appeared exceedingly rarely. As this new injection treatment took hold across Europe, the problem of GPI seemed to spread wildly. At the same time, doctors were finally discovering that syphilis and GPI went together. In 1857, F. Esmach and W. Jessen speculated that GPI was increasing and began to connect it with syphilis. Alfred Fournier, in 1876, first connected syphilis to tabes dorsalis, the affliction of the spinal cord, and over the next few years demonstrated conclusively that GPI occurred only in people infected with syphilis. By the end of the 19th century, it was clear that neurosyphilis in general, and GPI in particular, were part of the syphilis epidemic. By then, it was also clear that syphilis was far and away the most serious public health problem of the civilized world. Tomes of medical analysis and advice were written, more than on any other specific illness. GPI claimed the lives and minds of luminaries. Besides Nietzsche, there were Joyce, Maupassant, Baudelaire, Schumann, Schubert, and likely many more whose illnesses have been less clearly traced to the spirochete. Strangely, it was widely observed that no such celebrities appeared to have died in the 18th century from GPI, probably because Van Swieten's liquor did not come into wide use till around the turn of the century. In Vienna, the army garrison remained the focus of syphilis study, just as it had been in Van Swieten's day. Two army doctors named E. Matoschek and Alexander Pilch conducted the first systematic study of GPI rates among Austrian army officers. Published in 1913, their study examined the army officers treated according to the Viennese method between 1880 and 1910. The two doctors hewed close to the practice guidelines of the day and remained convinced of the efficacy of current protocols. Indeed, their article made a point of celebrating the success of mercury treatments and continued to support its use in their own patients. But there was a crucial error in their analysis. On average, GPI took about 15 years to develop after the initial syphilis infection, so it was important to control for the effect of time since treatment. Evaluating GPI rates in patients who had only recently been treated would drastically understate the true rate, which could only be assessed in groups where the disease had had sufficient time to develop, and while on the surface the GPI rates reported in the 1913 study looked modest enough, a rate of 4.7%, the sample of syphilitics included a wide range of treatment groups, some who had been treated 30 years before, and others who had been treated only a few years previously. This approach resulted in misleading findings. Later analysts would uncover Matoschek and Pilch's error. J. Abley, writing from Zurich in 1920, estimated a higher rate, between 9.75 and 13% of infected men, would eventually develop GPI. These subjects were followed for a period of 25 to 30 years, a time frame that could allow for full assessments of GPI rates. Most authors later accepted the validity of Abley's recalculations. Even less systematic studies tended to confirm the scourge of GPI. Everywhere one looked, there were high rates. At Johns Hopkins, close to 40% of white males with syphilis were afflicted with some form of neurosyphilis. Close to 10% were paretics. Neuropsychiatric wards all over the world saw GPI at rates of 5 to 35% of the entire caseload. But one part of Europe seemed exempt from this. As Ragnar Vogt had observed to Emil Kreplin, there sometimes was not a single GPI patient in Norway's main psychiatric hospital. The head of the Oslo Syphilis Clinic, a doctor named Caesar Beck, counted himself among the mercury skeptics. Based on years of clinical observation by his uncle Wilhelm, also a syphilologist, Caesar adopted his uncle's views on the adverse effects of mercury treatment. He decided as a matter of policy starting in 1890 that the Norwegian method would be different. Patients would be strictly quarantined, kept in the hospital during infectious stages, as long as 6 months, and treated locally with potassium iodide, along with topical treatments for skin rashes. Mercury was strictly forbidden. Speaking at the Medical Society in Oslo in 1909, Beck elaborated on the perspective that he and his uncle had shared. "I wish to touch upon the remarkable fact that in Denmark, where mercury therapy is in common use and, to the best of my knowledge, is as thoroughly conducted as in any other country. The relative number of paralytics in mental hospitals is more than twice as large as in Norway, where we have maintained an attitude of reservation as to the use of mercury in the treatment of syphilitics since the days of Wilhelm Beck. It will also have been noticed that, as compared with other countries, general paralysis is, on the whole, relatively uncommon in Norway, whereas this cannot be said of mental disorders in general." From 1890 to 1910, Beck emphasized the importance of keeping accurate statistics so patients could be followed up with. These records would become the basis for one of the most detailed studies ever on the effect of withholding mercury treatment. The beginning of the end. The end of the age of syphilis began, slowly, with the rise of another form of heavy metal injection as a treatment. This was salvarsan, an arsenic compound that burst on the scene in 1911 as Formula 606. Paul Ehrlich's so-called magic bullet offered all the hopes once held for mercury treatment. Ehrlich had received his medical education just a few years after George Lewin introduced mercury injections at the Charité Hospital in Berlin. As he worked systematically through a large number of chemical formulations, the 606th, an arsenic-based molecule that he called arsphenamine, proved more effective than mercuric chloride against syphilis. It also had the advantage of being less poisonous. The casualty-to-cure rate appeared to be more like 1 in 10, in contrast to mercury's much higher mortality rate. The ratio of 1 to 10 for mefarsin, an arsenic formulation, is the lowest of all the arsenical preparations used in the treatment of syphilis, wrote Joseph Earl Moore in The Modern Treatment of Syphilis. Moore, one of the world's leading syphilis experts, went on to give a gruesome assessment for the risk-benefit calculus for mercury. But with almost every mercury compound so far studied, the therapeutic ratio is 1 to 1, and never greater than 1 to 2, that is, the curative dose and the minimal lethal dose are so nearly identical that although the infection is destroyed, so is the animal. Still, mercury remained a part of the standard of care. Mercury injections often went alongside arsenic injections, and mercury inunctions remained the dermatological treatment of choice. The rise of Salvarsan had other unexpected consequences. In Norway, where Beck had long resisted mercury injections, Salvarsan changed their approach. From 1911 forward, Norway joined the rest of Europe in its activist approach to the treatment of new syphilis cases. In the meantime, however, from 1890 to 1910, the Beck cohort provided a fascinating test case for the effects, or lack thereof, of effectively untreated syphilis. In 1929, E. Brusgaard, one of Beck's successors, organized a study that provided a counterpoint to the study of Austrian army officers, with accurate records on 2,181 syphilis cases. Brusgaard's study included a follow-up analysis for Beck's original patients. In order to study the conditions of health 20 to 40 years later, he scoured the countryside for former patients, looking for a wide range of outcomes, most notably GPI. This was not an entirely controlled study, because these patients might have received some other form of therapy, including mercury, in the intervening years. Private clinics in Norway and nearby countries were using mercury treatments, and by 1929, arsenic treatments were common. But while not as clean a study as, say, the study of culturally separate Native Americans, the effect of Beck's approach would be evident, nevertheless. Brusgaard was able to obtain detailed reports on 473 of the original 2,000-plus patients, but still believed he had found every case of GPI in Norway. He found 13 cases, including patients who died, in a population of 2.2 million, confirming Vogt's reports of the virtual absence of GPI in the country. It was Brusgaard's study that finally shook the profession of syphilology to its foundation. GPI, the most feared and fatal consequence of the dreaded pox, present in 10% or more of the recipients of the Vienna treatment, was virtually non-existent among those who had received no mercury treatment at all. What did that say about the centuries of effort on the part of the European medical profession? Could doctors, in their attempt to treat the surface symptoms of a hideous physical condition, have planted the seed for a far greater mental and physical affliction? Excavating documents and studies from decades and even centuries ago, when diagnostic categories and data collection standards were far different, is no easy task. But neither is it impossible. Perhaps no single study on its own is strong enough to definitively prove that GPI was a result of treatment with mercury or other similar toxins. But the cumulative record makes the argument difficult to dismiss. And the cumulative record on GPI and syphilis treatment includes the most notorious study in American medical history. Any number of contemporary observers had commented that neurosyphilis was hard to find among blacks, and there was a belief that syphilis affected the races differently, specifically that whites disproportionately had neurological problems, and blacks displayed cardiovascular symptoms. A study at Johns Hopkins in 1922 found the rate of GPI among black men at 2%, well below the rate for white men, 8.5%, which was attributed to a racial difference in disease risk. But we also know the poor black population, like the Native American population, was less likely to receive the Vienna treatment than their more affluent and Europeanized white counterparts. The ongoing syphilis epidemic in the United States spurred a number of efforts to measure the extent of the syphilis problem in the country. Some of the highest rates of the disease were among poor blacks in the rural South. Surveys in Macon County, Alabama, put the rate as high as 40%. A considerable portion of the infected Negro population remained untreated during the entire course of syphilis, wrote U.S. public health officials. Such individuals seemed to offer a unique opportunity to study the syphilitic illness from the beginning of the disease to the death of the infected person. Thus, the Tuskegee experiment was born. Formally named the Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Male Negro. At the outset of the study in 1932, particularly in light of the Brusgaard findings in Norway, the idea of withholding treatment from the local population would have included the absence of arsenic and mercury injections and mercury rubs. Some could argue that, in hindsight, this offered the population a greater opportunity for a healthy life since it removed any possibility of complications from these treatments. But truly, the ethics of this study were compromised from the start. First, the treatments withheld were considered, at the time, at least by mainstream medicine, to be beneficial and were received by the majority of the population. Above and beyond this injustice, participants were not given informed consent and generally were viewed as laboratory animals rather than as a disadvantaged group deserving high-quality government care. They were not told they had syphilis, but that they had bad blood that the public health system promised to help them control. To entice participants, the federal government provided physical examinations and incidental medications such as tonics and analgesics. The Milbank Memorial Fund's offer of burial assistance to indigent families made possible a higher degree of post-mortem examinations. Free medication, though not to treat syphilis. Free hot meals. Free rides to the doctors, which included the opportunity to stop in town to shop or visit with their friends on the streets, all helped encourage the men to enlist and kept them coming back. Macon County, home of the Tuskegee Institute, lies in Alabama's Black Belt, named for its rich soil. The lives of its poor blacks were little changed from post-Civil War sharecropper days. More than 3,000 blacks were eking out a living on depleted land in the middle of the Depression. They plowed with mules, and roads to town were often too rudimentary and rutted to reach in an automobile. There were 10 physicians in the county, only one of them black, and none accessible to blacks in southern and southwestern portions of the county. The county was more than 80% black at the time. The project managers of the Tuskegee experiment recruited 600 study participants, 399 of whom had syphilis determined by 2 positive test results, and 201 who were uninfected, with the aim of following all of them on through to death. An early publication noted that the incidence and character of syphilis among African Americans had been a controversial topic for many years. The authors noted 2 camps. One group who believed that GPI and tabes dorsalis were not common in African Americans, and a second that believed their frequency was essentially the same as in whites. Although the authors emphasized the common occurrence of central nervous system symptoms in their 399 untreated cases, and even invented a category called benign parenchymatous type, meaning there was evidence of syphilis in the spinal fluid but absolutely no symptoms of neurosyphilis, they nevertheless had to admit that serious neurosyphilis was rare in this study group. With regard to the benign parenchymatous type, such cases did not appear to run the usual classic course of dementia paralytica, GPI, or of tabes dorsalis. No typical cases of dementia paralytica or tabes dorsalis were noted, but one case of simple dementia was found. In order to be certain that there was no selection of cases through loss to institutions for the insane, it was learned that not a single male Negro over 25 years of age was confined with syphilis of the central nervous system in the Searcy Hospital at Mount Vernon, Alabama, where the Negro insane in this state are hospitalized. It's worth emphasizing the statement buried in the middle of this article. In the American population with the highest rate of syphilis ever measured, where the benefits of modern European civilization were just a few miles, or in some cases a few years away, the most dreaded form of syphilis, general paralysis of the insane, not to mention its close cousin, tabes dorsalis, was nowhere to be found. GPI was not found in the study population that the researchers had selected, nor anywhere that it might have been expected to show up, such as the state mental hospital. Unlike the Beck-Brusgaard study in Norway, which was a follow-up of a previously identified population, this first study in Tuskegee simply provided a snapshot in time, a look at the entire disease burden at a given moment in a given population, and including residents ranging from the age of 25 into their 60s and 70s. As the years passed, the study continued. Following this first examination in 1932 to 1933, five subsequent surveys were performed over the next 30 years. In 1939, 1948, 1952, 1954, and 1962. Each round of surveys and examinations stimulated a new round of scientific analysis and publications, of which there were a dozen in all before public outrage finally brought the study to an abrupt end in 1972. Although observers have tended to lump the whole Tuskegee project into one sordid episode, it's worth considering the project in two periods, before and after the invention of penicillin. Before penicillin, the untreated Tuskegee patients were being investigated in the context of the Brusgaard-Oslo challenge, in which patients with untreated syphilis, in hindsight, may have had advantages over those treated with mercury and arsenic. Following the introduction of penicillin, however, every day in which treatment was withheld was another day of effective treatment denied. The way this unfolded is charted in these two tables. In the 1932 study, none of the patients had received treatment of any kind. But over the next two survey rounds, well over half of the study population were found to have received some form of treatment on their own. By 1938, 115 of the 270 surviving patients reported receiving treatment, which at that time would have always been in the form of mercury or arsenic injections. In 1948, nearly three-quarters, 72%, of the study group had received treatment. Since mercury and arsenic were still considered viable treatments, these individuals had to be removed from the study group. The removal of these participants was always disappointing to those running the experiment, as it was considered a clear weakness of the study. In those early follow-ups, although not surprisingly, the authors found evidence that having syphilis seemed to increase the risk of negative neurological effects in infected subjects as compared to subjects with no infection at all. They were still unable to locate any cases of GPI. All that started to change by the early 1950s as a series of remarkable developments took the study down a darker path. Into the late 1940s, there were legitimate questions about the true efficacy of penicillin as a syphilis treatment. But by the 1950s, the benefits of penicillin had become compellingly clear. In the second table, some new dimensions of the study are apparent. First, as the curative powers of the new wonder drug became obvious, the Tuskegee scientists decided to take all the patients they had previously bemoaned as lost from the study group because they had received treatment and returned them to the study sample, grouping together an inadequately treated subset with cases who had never received treatment. Most of this new subset were deemed inadequately treated because they hadn't received enough arsenic injections. Patients who received full arsenic treatment were still excluded, but a sizable minority had received mercury injections sometime along the way. None had received penicillin, the new standard of care, and GPI, which had remained undetected during the first three surveys, had begun to make an appearance in this population. Three of the 92 patients receiving an autopsy by 1952 were reported to have died with GPI. At this point, the researchers concluded that if they could make sure none of the participants got the new adequate treatment, penicillin, they could resume the study with a much larger population. Sidney Olansky, the director of the project on behalf of the Public Health Service, commented that medical progress has not been so great nor medical care so widespread among our patients in Macon County as to defeat the project as a study of untreated syphilis. Despite the present prevalent use of antibiotics with their known anti-syphilitic potency, the study group remains untreated. This specific choice to deny penicillin treatment to those men was the worst decision these researchers made. That these men were exploited from the outset as lab rats rather than cared for as human beings is a terrible tragedy. But widespread revulsion about the project as a whole, which is deserved, has also obscured the additional outrage of this moment. Along with the decision to undertake the experiment in the first place, it was just as great a moral failure on the part of the Public Health Service to insist on continuing its prospective epidemiology study after the historic introduction of penicillin should have overtaken it and shut it down. Instead of the kind of introspection that might have produced a change in course, the investigators seemed instead never to have considered it. Rather, they praised themselves for their selfless contributions to medical knowledge. It seems appropriate, after 20 years of experience, to comment upon some of the operational aspects of the study which, to our knowledge, is the first prospective, longitudinal, long-term study involving the ideal of 100% observation of a large group of diseased and control patients through life to autopsy. A quality of dedication to the ideal of a long-term study based upon love of and respect for the dignity of the individual within the group, and upon the satisfaction of making a single valuable contribution to the increment of knowledge, without concern for credit, is fundamental. The beginning of this survey in 1952 coincided with a visit to the United States of Trygve Gjestland of Norway, the chief worker in a contemporary re-examination and re-evaluation of the survivors of the Beck-Brusgaard study. At the invitation of the Division of Venereal Disease, he visited Tuskegee and observed the first group of patients as they were examined. He saw firsthand the remarkable socioeconomic and racial difference between the rural Alabama Negro farmers and the fair-skinned Norwegians he has been studying. As the first aged men trooped into the hospital for re-examination, Dr. Gjestland and the examiners felt as if they were witnessing a strange and historic procession. Their feelings were similar to those of Brusgaard in Oslo, who wrote in 1929, "It produced a curious impression to see these patients after so many years, several of them over 70. A strikingly large percent of the cases were free of clinical symptoms. Many of these patients had apparently tried to undermine their health by an unreasonable mode of life, but had not succeeded." The fine art of burying your mistakes. During the shift, roughly from 1911 to 1943, from the use of mercury injections to penicillin, two drastically different standards of care, a flurry of treatments developed, further complicating the distinction between adequate and inadequate treatment. Most notable was arsenic-based salvarsan, for which Paul Ehrlich won the Nobel Prize in 1908. Another Nobel winner for syphilis treatment was Viennese Dr. Julius Wagner Jauregg in 1927. He pioneered the idea of treating syphilis with fever therapy, induced by infecting patients with malaria. The idea was that the high fevers could actually kill the spirochete. As penicillin later proved, regardless of the toxic background, if the spirochete could be killed, GPI would be stopped in its tracks. The disadvantages of malaria therapy, however, were manifold, including a mortality rate of around 5%. Thus, it is hard to know the exact toll of mercury treatments for syphilis in the first half of the 20th century, and what the rate of GPI was, though in Europe's hospitals the toll was clearly large. Perhaps the most reliable estimate is Abley's recalculation of the Austrian Army officer treatment grouping, in which roughly 10% or more of men treated with mercuric chloride injections for syphilis developed GPI. On the other side of the coin, the untreated populations from the Native Americans that Kanner and Kraepelin inquired about to Beck and Brusgaard's Oslo cohort, GPI in untreated syphilitic patients was nearly non-existent, quite possibly zero. Salvarsan, while less toxic, seemed not to eliminate the risk of GPI in the treatment group. Indeed, arsenic might have had a similar, though less toxic, effect as mercury. One study in Denmark showed the long-term rate of GPI in Salvarsan patients at 3-4%. Up to the very last moment before the arrival of penicillin, syphilis experts claimed extraordinary progress with ever more sophisticated application of heavy metals, mercury very much included, and fever therapy. At Johns Hopkins, Dr. Joseph Earl Moore's Modern Treatment of Syphilis included a chapter on the virtues of mercury treatment with numerous unattributed statistics and extravagant claims about the benefits of heavy metals and the dangers of leaving syphilis untreated. With the advent of penicillin, by the end of the decade, however, this kind of modern treatment instantly became a quaint concept. Still, it continued to pose an interesting dilemma for professional syphilologists, even as they embraced the first medicine that offered unambiguous benefits. How would history treat their efforts? Kraepelin's and Kanner's investigations into obscure populations were more easily dismissed. But the Oslo study, with its modern prospective design and its convincing critique of inadequate treatment in the form of mercury, offered a sour endnote to the age of syphilis. To be sure, the Tuskegee study showed that having syphilis wasn't good for you even if it remained untreated. It had long-term effects on cardiovascular health and generally reduced life expectancy. But the question remained, did mercury have benefits for the patient, or would the world have been better off without the Vienna treatment and its successors? Dr. Moore decided to take action. He enlisted a young, ambitious Norwegian, Trygve Gjestland, the same doctor who had watched the parade of elderly patients into the Tuskegee clinic, to undertake an exhaustive re-examination of Brusgaard's influential 1920 Oslo study. On its face, the Oslo study of untreated syphilis was an odd exercise. It was published in 1955, after penicillin carried the day, and at 329 dense, chart-filled pages, it was 14 times longer than Brusgaard's original paper. But behind the scenes, the project mattered a lot. In his preface, Gjestland notes that Moore had visited Oslo and that he and J.R. Heller, then chief of the Venereal Disease Division of the U.S. Public Health Service and a key player in the Tuskegee study, used their influence in securing funds to finance the study. American syphilis doctors, in effect, helped initiate and fund a study in Scandinavia to vindicate their own medical practices in the United States. If the concept of inadequate treatment in syphilis studies was an exercise in moving goalposts, the Gjestland study was an exercise in lowering the denominator. Brusgaard had calculated the rate of GPI, a minuscule 0.6%, by dividing GPI cases by the entire population of male participants, 793, in Beck's mercury-free treatment regimen. Gjestland instead divided cases by the smaller number of participants who could be tracked down in 1928. He also failed to separate out those who had subsequently been treated with arsenic. That gave him a rate of 2.9% with GPI, still a relatively small number, but enough to obscure the virtual non-existence of the disease. Still, what took 329 pages? A big enough barrage of statistics and digressions for its sponsors to get what they were paying for. The manufacture of doubt. What's breathtaking here is the lack of a reality check. Vogt, the psychiatrist quoted by Kraepelin, had said there were times the big mental hospital in Norway had no cases of GPI at all. Brusgaard had managed to find records for just 13 men, alive and dead, in the whole country. Elsewhere in Europe, the asylums were bulging with them. But the Mercury apologists sowed enough confusion to avoid acknowledging one of the most catastrophic medical treatments in history, one that went on for centuries. Geestlin's prodigiously muddled verdict was, for all intents and purposes, the last word on the age of syphilis. There were a few dissensions. One Danish author reminded readers in a diplomatically worded review that Geestland had lost the point of Brusgaard's original concern in his 329 pages, which was that mercury treatments were worse than the disease. In today's medical texts, the age of syphilis is marked by the singular triumph of penicillin and some discussion of the American origins, or not, of T. pallidum. The centuries of poisoning with mercury and the iatrogenic horrors of GPI play no role in these histories, which are reserved for the progress of medical innovation. But we take a different set of lessons from this history. Syphilis had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It had an age. And so did general paralysis of the insane. The first reports started trickling in at the end of the 18th century. Then, clusters of cases were noted. Then the incidence rate soared until penicillin was used to kill the bacteria. As we saw in the case of Karen Wetterhahn, the scientist at Dartmouth, even fatal doses can take months to show their first signs. The latency between first exposure to mercury and first symptoms of illness can be remarkably long. Likewise, the long trajectory of GPI made it hard to connect it to syphilis, let alone to mercury treatments. But once the syphilis spirochete dies off, neurosyphilis stops. So what exactly was the role of mercury? We don't know. But multiple streams of evidence suggest that internal use of mercury drove the microbe mad, that without the ingestion or injection of mercuric chloride as a treatment, there was essentially no general paralysis of the insane. Medicine created a hideous manifestation of the disease it was designed to treat, then performed more twists and turns than the spirochete itself, in order to avoid the stark reality of cause and effect.